What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krawczyk. John, there is no question that in America today, one of the big demographic trends is the fact that young people want to live in an urban environment.
Oh, yeah.
Would you agree with that?
New York and Boston, at least in our area, are booming with young people. So, yeah, I agree.
In fact, I was talking to somebody who's involved with an accounting firm that is throughout the Northeast. And, John, it was remarkable. He was telling me that in the first quarter of this year, Boston, its economic output grew by 4.8%.
Wow.
Boston is buzzing.
Yeah, wow.
It better, yeah. Because I'm telling you, these young people coming out of these intellectual factories in Boston, and they are motivated, they're smart, they know the new technology, but they're living in one of the most expensive cities in the entire country.
I don't know if Boston is as bad as New York, but I know New York is outrageous.
Oh, yeah. And there are a lot of people moving out of New York. But, you know, there is a trend that is also going on where a lot of people from the suburbs, particularly as you age, may not find that suburban living is still the best style for them because they're alone, they're isolated, and they want to come back into cities. And so there's this interesting repurposing of many communities. The New York Times did a front page piece the other day about Raleigh, North Carolina, where we used to have integration in America by virtue of African Americans moving up socioeconomically and moving into white neighborhoods.
Right.
But just the opposite is beginning to occur, where white people from the suburbs are starting to move into the inner city and repopulating areas that were formerly black owned and operated.
Wow,
yeah, it's fascinating.
About this.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And a lot of black people who can afford to go out to the suburbs and live that suburban dream are starting to move out and into inner city areas or inner ring suburbs of various cities. So it's kind of a reverse migration that's going on.
Yeah.
The other trend that's going on, John, is that a lot of young people who may start out in Boston or New York recognize that those aren't the only places where they can celebrate the education that they've gotten, that there are a lot of mid-sized cities in America that are offering incredibly rich opportunities for them at a lesser rate.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of, I know Maine has got a very aggressive to get young people there. They'll pay off loans. I know for certain types of work, they're trying to get young people to come to Maine. So I know there are states doing that.
Absolutely. And I think in this podcast that we're going to offer you in just a moment, you're going to hear from a fascinating guy who is a four-term mayor of one of those cities that is absolutely thriving. And I was talking about this with a friend of mine, and he said, oh, I have a friend who lives in Oklahoma City, and that's where Mick Cornett was the mayor. And he wrote this book, The Next American City. And he said, Oklahoma City is just alive and vibrant.
Wow.
And a lot of that can be traced to not only Mick, but to other mayors before him and some really interesting approaches they've taken to revitalizing the river in Oklahoma City, to making more livable spaces in the city, to making it culturally rich. They've done many, many unique different things.
We got to have him talk to our governor.
Well, Connecticut is a little behind in terms of revitalizing a lot of its urban areas.
Fresh ideas here.
Yeah. But there are cities like Akron, Ohio, Scranton, Pennsylvania, places like Provo, Utah, Indianapolis, Minneapolis. And if they're not on your radar today, they should be, because these are places that really are abundant in opportunity. And I know even my daughter, John, who lives in Boston, she and her boyfriend, and they're expecting to get married over the next couple of years, they're starting to talk about that.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of my daughter, like I was saying, was looking for jobs And when she was in her looking, she found Maine to be very inviting. So I'm sure there's other lot of cities out there that see that they need to bring the young people back in to, you know, revitalize them. So they're offering them, you know, perks.
Yeah, various incentives. Perks, yeah. I mean, everyone does it for economic development. So Mick Cornett, in writing this book, he wants us to make certain that we understand that replete throughout the country are these examples of mid-sized cities. And they're rebuilding themselves, but on different platforms. It's not all the same cookie-cutter approach.
Right.
What he did in Oklahoma City is very different than what they're doing in Des Moines or Louisville or Albuquerque or Sacramento, Buffalo, different kinds of medical startups.
But,
in
but
one.
At least they're thinking outside the box and you know, doing things that are bringing their city back instead of forcing people out.
Exactly. And certain states haven't caught up, but many are. So there's a new kind of street smarts that's going on, and these are in the next American city. Let's find out what they are, and don't move just yet, but think about it. With us on the line, and I'll call him Mayor Mick Cornett. He's not currently the mayor, but was the four-term mayor of Oklahoma City and did a remarkable job in Oklahoma City. And he's written a book called The Next American City, The Big Promise of Our Mid-Size Metros. And there seems to be so much energy, based upon what I've read in your book, in these smaller cities. Now, we hear often, you know, Mayor, about San Francisco and New York and Atlanta, but we don't hear about these smaller size cities, and yet you tell us that's where the action is.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, there is all sorts of data that is suggesting that on a percentage basis, these mid-sized metros, so think Oklahoma City, Tulsa, Little Rock, Des Moines, Louisville, Charleston, cities of that size are going to outgrow our largest metro centers going forward. And I think the reason that most experts are kind of gravitating towards is that millennial generation and the generation coming in behind it seem very interested in the quality of life in their community. And they take into account such attributes as the cost of living, traffic congestion, fresh water, and clean air. And in some parts of the United States, you know, you can't have any of those three, and it's pretty hard to find all three in one place. Yet in the mid-sized metro area, there's a lot of cities that offer these amenities and more. And it just seems like it's a sweet spot that is really going to be attracting a lot of attention over the next 10 to 20 years.
And of course, you can speak of this as a result of your experiences in Oklahoma City. And I think a lot of us have been introduced to Oklahoma City by way of Russell Westbrook and OKC. And that has given great identity to your community. But tell us, over the period of time that you were the mayor, so much has changed within Oklahoma City as a great representative example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think no city's come as far as fast as Oklahoma City, but that's partially because we had so far to go. And my predecessors did an incredible job of planting seeds. And so, you know, back in 1993, the city of Oklahoma City kind of established that it was going to diversify its economy, start investing in the inner city, create a downtown that the entire region could be proud of. And today, it's a vibrant core with, you know, thousands of millennials flocking to Oklahoma City from places like Texas and California, which are parts of the country that we had been losing populations to in generations past. And so it's really good to see. And, you know, the momentum is continuing. We just opened up the largest startup streetcar system in the United States. We have a brand new convention center that is under construction. We have a Omni Hotel is building adjacent to them. And we have a really large urban park that's going to be opening in September, about $140 million park, really impressive project. And I think, you know, one of the things that people should notice is that it helps to always have something on the drawing board and something under construction and something coming out of the ground. In other words, opening something is wonderful, but your population really benefits if they know what's coming next. And in Oklahoma City, we've had about 25 years plus now of people being able to talk about what's coming next. And my dad used to tell me, this is years ago, he's long departed us, but he said that happiness is having something to look forward to. And I think we've kind of proven that in Oklahoma City, that we have extremely high approval ratings, city government. And I think part of it is because they love telling our story to their family and friends around the country.
Well, I've got to tell you that we are emanating today, our end, from a city that is part of a rust belt in the Northeast. And we used to be the brass capital of the world. And we've been struggling for an identity ever since. Now, there was the energy bust of the 1980s that led to a lot of creative thinking in Oklahoma City as to where do we go from here. And I remember Churchill, at least he was credited as saying, now that we've run out of money, we've really got to start thinking. I mean, what was the impetus for some of the great ideas that came out of Oklahoma City? And where did they come from? Because we did another podcast with Bruce Katz from the Brookings Institution based on the new localism. And he said the energy comes not only from the public sector, but the education sector, the health sector, and the college sector. Where did it come from in Oklahoma City?
I think the business sector, largely, we have a really strong chamber of commerce who realized that the city was not going to live up to its destiny if we didn't get everybody pulling on the same rope. And so I think Oklahoma City is an example of a great collaboration between the private sector and the public sector, and indeed the universities in creating and investing in our innovation district. So I think Bruce is exactly right. There was a monumental tipping point in Oklahoma City's history. You go back two mayors before me, there was a mayor named Ron Norick who was trying to get an economic development effort from United Airlines to build a maintenance facility in Oklahoma City. And he put together a huge incentive package. And at the end of the day, we finished second. And what United told us was that the quality of life in Oklahoma City was so poor that they just couldn't imagine their employees living there. Mm. And what that taught Oklahoma City was we had to invest in ourselves before we could ever expect anyone from the outside to come invest in us. And that was really the lesson that mayor and the business community at the time learned. And that's when we started investing in the core of the city, you know, creating a vibrant core. And I've long believed that the quality of life in the suburbs is directly related to the intensity of the core. And we had allowed our core to die.
Absolutely. And in Connecticut, we bought into the suburban solution so early and so hard, and we've let a lot of our core cities go to seed, and we're trying to rebuild, but it's a very difficult process. What would you say to all of those cities? You talk about the fact that you've really got to think forward, and yet a lot of cities are just grasping at straws, and they're not doing the work, the groundwork that's needed to entice in a way that is organic, and they're just praying for a Hail Mary. For example, look at all the communities that were looking to have the second headquarters for Amazon. Were they just, you know, batting in the breeze?
Well, some of them were. You know, the real key is that any private sector business has got to locate in an area where they can attract a highly educated workforce. And if you don't have a community that a highly educated workforce is going to want to live or choose to live, then your chances of landing, you know, the big economic development opportunity of the future is just not very good. You've got to create a quality of life that can attract highly educated 20-somethings. So notice what they're looking for and then try to create that city, because it's a very entrepreneurial generation. If you can attract highly educated 20-somethings, they are going to create an economy for you. Every time I see a millennial with a cell phone, I wonder to myself if they're over there starting a business. You know, I mean, it doesn't take much to start a business anymore. And that generation doesn't see the impediments that, that my generation would have seen. And so it's really about attracting talent. And then Bruce Katz is a really good communicator on innovation districts and placemaking and that public-private university partnership that's so important. A lot of those things are important too. But at the end of the day, people have to want to live there. And that's where city leaders should be concentrating. Do people want to live in our city? And can they afford to live in our city? Do we have, have we taken care of the traffic congestion issues? Do we have fresh water and clean air? You know, millennials want to live in a city that understands all those things are important.
But there's a catch-22 here. How do you attract those young people, particularly you have experience having been in a flyover community, and so it's not, along the beaches, it's not one of the sexy places in America, and you were at the precipice of really going into the hole. I mean, you had a river that was a ditch. You had a downtown that had all these urban renewal efforts that had failed. I mean, you were really close to the edge of a true disaster. And yet, how do you get the community to invest enough in itself to become that attractive magnet for these very discerning young people?
Well, and sometimes that is the key issue. In other words, does City Hall or does city leadership have the political capital to perhaps pass an initiative that's going to pay for the type of investments that I'm talking about? You know, what we have been very protective of in Oklahoma City is that the government did what it said it was going to do. In other words, we have built up political capital through the decades now because we have completed and fulfilled our promises to the voters. And so if you have political capital issues, that's another early hurdle to try and address. We have also tried to make sure that the community took ownership in our initiatives. In other words, that they felt a part of it. And getting people to vote for something is one aspect of that. But we've also insisted that we have citizen advisory boards that oversaw the construction of the projects. And so it really is a citizen-led initiative. Citizens vote on it. Citizens help us build it. And at the end of the day, you know, the citizens will judge for themselves whether or not that tax investment was worth it. You know, I think what's undeniable in Oklahoma City is that we've created a city that has a much better chance of keeping the next generation in our town. When I was growing up in Oklahoma City, most of my high school classmates and college classmates ultimately left because if they had a higher level of education, there just weren't jobs for those types of educational investments. And today, that's not the case. And I've always thought, you know, even someone who really hesitates to pass any sort of tax initiative cares about their kids and their grandkids. And realize that you've got to create a city that's going to attract them and create a job for them. And we've been able to do that and have, you know, kind of kept that momentum going.
I want to look beyond Oklahoma City, but it is such a fascinating laboratory that you developed there and other mayors before you. And this whole notion of MAPS, metropolitan area projects. And a lot of people have a difficult time getting their arms around these huge bonding initiatives. And yet you've done it in a different way, where you didn't really borrow money to pay for these projects. It was only when you had a sales tax that raised enough revenue did the building begin. Explain whether that is unique to Oklahoma City or you see that being adopted in other places.
Well, it's fairly unique, and it's a pay-as-you-go philosophy. In other words, we start a sales tax, and as we collect the money, we start the process of completing the projects. You know, you hire the architects and the engineers, and then you start the construction process. Now, it takes a lot longer to build the projects because of that. You know, if you bond it out, you can almost start building the projects, you know, overnight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the original MAPS vote occurred in December of 93. The project started opening up in 98, and then they were completed in 03, so some 10 years later. And so it takes a political climate where one group of leadership is willing to help pass an initiative and help construct it, knowing that there will be other leaders around to cut the ribbons later on. But, you know, it requires a continuum of leadership. In other words, a lot of cities, I think, struggle because, you know, they elect a mayor, and that mayor doesn't agree or doesn't get along with the previous mayor or the next mayor, and you end up with all these stops and starts. And, you know, in Oklahoma City, we've been very fortunate and very protective of having leadership that was willing to complete the projects of a previous administration and then start realizing what was needed to be next, knowing that it might be a future mayor that would be cutting the ribbon on that project somewhere down the line.
You know where I see that so often is in the education leadership of superintendencies, where somebody develops a reform package and then they move on to the next carousel stop, which is more lucrative for them, and they have a reform package that the next person throws out and starts over again. And, you know, the educational system, I would imagine, in Oklahoma City is an important inducement to keeping the next generation. So how were you able, even if your municipal leadership had that continuum, were you able to affect that on education issues?
It was difficult. And on the inner city education front, if you go back to the 1990s, the results were not only embarrassing, but the school buildings themselves were physically falling apart. And we had so much deferred maintenance into that district that someone did the math and said, you know, even if they were able to pass a bond issue, they'll never catch up to the deferred maintenance they're facing. And the business leaders of the community realized it was, you know, some sort of a civic emergency. And literally, we got state law changed or we could pass a sales tax and help bail out that inner city district. And so we have now, you know, completed the capital renovations for that district, you know, improved or built anew all 75 buildings in the inner city school district. And the education going on inside the classroom is better. You know, we, like every other large city with an urban core, struggles with inner city education. But at least in a nicer building, a kid's more likely to want to go to school, or a teacher's more likely to want to teach there, or a parent is more likely to want to be there on parent-teacher night. And so our continued success is that the business leaders of the community have kind of put their arms around that inner city district and realize that the district's problems are everybody's problem. And I think that's an important component, because the previous paradigm was that nobody really wanted to be associated with the disastrous results coming out of that district. And instead, political leaders, business leaders kind of said, look, we've all got to work together and try and help the district out of this situation. And so minimally, there is an emotional support system for that district and a willingness to help. And that emotional buy-in, I think, is critically important. We're still struggling, like everybody else, though, to get better and better grades and better performance levels out of our district. But it feels like we're heading in the right direction.
Leadership. We've talked about it on some level, but there are many who look at the elections on the municipal level and say many of them in America, not in your city, I don't believe, are nonpartisan. We don't know whether it's a Democrat or it's a Republican, and it really doesn't matter. And yet, I think also on the local level, even if it is a Democrat or Republican, given the fact that the old saying goes, there's not a Democratic or Republican way to shovel a street or whatever it may be, you have to have many more practical solutions. How important is it to have a certain type of leadership in a community to make any of this go? Or is it that the leader just really has to understand how to pull together the dynamics of their community? And sometimes, as one of your chapter suggests, the best thing is not to do something and to know your community well enough to figure out what opportunities to pursue and which to push away from.
Yeah, we do run a nonpartisan political system inside the city government. And I think it's important to keep partisanship out of City Hall, because really the issues that City Hall works on are not partisan by nature. You know, it's about police officers and firefighters and building streets and creating parks. You know, there shouldn't be a significant amount of partisanship in all of that. And so I think that the mayors here in Oklahoma City have been results-oriented. And you know, when I was the mayor, I just said, look, I want to get things done. I don't care whose idea it is, but we got to get things done. And I think when you look at legislative bodies at the state and the federal level, what you see is a lot of talk and not a lot of action. In other words, I think people are frustrated that more doesn't get accomplished. Seems like there's great debate, but the debate doesn't lead to results often enough. And at the local level, I think people and demand it. I mean, you're so close to people when you're, you know, elected at the local level that people will notice, you know, whether or not you're wasting their time, and they're going to expect results. And so there's been a lot of times I didn't get everything I wanted, but I figured out where the votes were and we negotiated the best we could. And then we moved on to the next issue without carrying the baggage, you know, of the politics of the previous day or the previous week. In other words, you forget it and you move on and you do the best you can. And so, you know, we have great political discussions in Oklahoma City Hall, but at the end of the day, it's about getting things done and compromising and moving on to the next issue so we can tackle the next problem that we're facing.
The former four-term mayor of Oklahoma City, with an incredible record to show for it, Mick Cornett, is on the line with us. The next American city, the big promise of our mid-sized metros. And you decided for this book to select a number of those communities and tell us their story. For example, you decided to focus on the fact that Buffalo, now Buffalo, New York, is really a very hot medical startup district. And you say the talent comes from just about anywhere. And here you had a gentleman from Buffalo, Pat Whalen. He's a retired logistics entrepreneur turned ski bum. And under his direction, over the course of about 8 years, the district went from 3 startups to 140. Briefly tell us their story so we can tell some of the other stories as well.
Well, yeah, one of the examples, I mean, and Pat Whalen's a great example, of unleashing the leadership that's already in your community. In other words, Pat wasn't elected to anything, but Pat probably needed, you know, some empowerment from government leaders and business leaders, and was willing to create, you know, great, you know, ideas and concepts, and a lot of good could be created. There are people in every community willing to help. I think it's up to a mayor and it's up to business leaders to find these individuals out there who can make really good things happen if they concentrate on it. And, you know, I've found them here in Oklahoma City, and I think Pat's a good example of one person accomplishing a lot, but never, you know, never being elected to, you know, to a public office to accomplish those things. And so, you know, when communities are out there trying to figure out how do we do this and how do we do that, a lot of times it's just finding those passionate people who know how to get things done, and they're out there.
You also looked at New Orleans post-Katrina and asked the question, how do you build a city beyond boom and bust? I mean, how do you do that? Because, you know, again, you may grasp at the, you know, fastest opportunity that comes along, but you really want to build for the long term. So how do you know that you're really building this in a way that is sustainable?
Well, I think sustainable is a key word when you talk about these investments. And in New Orleans' case, you know, they were looking at a post-Katrina environment where a lot of money was going to be coming in to try and resurrect that great American city. And I think it was important that they spend it on things that were going to be long-lasting. In other words, don't spend it on short-term feel-good projects, but spend it on things that will that you can build on and that can lead to things that are a catalyst, you know, for further investment. And I think, you know, New Orleans struggled, you know, mightily in the years immediately following Katrina, but eventually, you know, started finding its pockets of success and found some areas they can build on. And, you know, I still think it's one of the most beautiful, underrated cities out there.
Oh, absolutely. Louisville, Kentucky. I found this fascinating. Mayor Greg Fisher. Now, we think of this as a rather conservative part of the country, and yet mindfulness and meditation? Really?
Yeah. Mayor Greg Fisher decided that he wanted Louisville to be known as a city of compassion. And when I first heard that, I didn't really understand what he meant and what he was talking about. You know, in Oklahoma City, we typically are working on something with, you know, with an ROI that we can calculate and see and judge later. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how do you judge compassion? But when I saw it actually implemented and I saw the many ways that he instituted compassion into his city staff, into his city employees, into the school system, and I thought, you know, how much better would a community be if every citizen there realized that they were prioritizing compassion and it was an expectation in the community that they were going to be more compassionate than they had been previously or that others might be? the metrics on that are astonishing if you start to think about it. Now, it might be hard to measure. It might be hard to, you know, to come up with an exact measurement on things like that. But I think it's very real. And I just wanted to draw attention to Mayor Fisher and the fact that he took, I thought, great political risk in deciding to spend, you know, his limited political capital on an idea of compassion, which really didn't have much of a definition and certainly, you know, no examples elsewhere of how this could be implemented. But you can feel it. And when you talk to people there, you understand that it's very real. A community can be the better if they can latch on to ideas and concepts like that. But the fact that he purposely directed his city in that direction, I think is amazing.
But look what you did at the beginning. I mean, you got national attention for Oklahoma City by telling the city that it had to go on a diet and that it needed to lose 1 million pounds. No, but that was a great idea because the health of the city, the vibrancy, the outdoor environment that you needed to build to encourage more walking and more exercise. I mean, that was something that was lofty and different, but I think it had a lot of practical application on the ground.
Yes, and I do think there's some similarities into what Mayor Fisher did and that initiative that I started back in 2007. What I felt was that obesity was a significant issue in Oklahoma City. I didn't really know how to deal with it, but I did know that the first step had to be a conversation because obesity had become a subject that we didn't feel comfortable discussing. You know, obesity affects the way people look and, you know, we're nice people and, you know, we don't talk about people if you're not going to say nice things. And I just think our unannounced strategy about obesity was to ignore it. And, you know, you could see that wasn't going to get us anywhere. So really what that initiative did in retrospect is it forced our community to discuss obesity and get husbands and wives talking about it and church pastors talking about it at the pulpit, business leaders talking about it with their employees. And that's very powerful. And ultimately, we had 47,000 people sign up. They chronicled 1 million pounds over a 4-year period. But I think, you know, the greater gain at the end of the day is that we use that awareness campaign to then pass a series of funding initiatives to rebuild the built environment, to be less reliant on the automobile, to be more pedestrian friendly, and we've created a healthier community. And now 10 years plus after that initial, you know, this city is going on a diet campaign, our health statistics are improving. I mean, the county health board can look across 20 different metrics and show you that heart disease is down, strokes are down. You know, all of these really critical measurements that Oklahoma City had never done well in before, we're doing better. And so, you know, health is still something that we have to continue to work on. I'm not suggesting that we figured all of this out, but we are heading in the right direction. There's undeniably an understanding of how important health is in the community and an understanding that we had created a city for cars instead of people.
Exactly.
And all of those have been paradigm shifts in our community that have happened because of that.
Well, Mayor Mick Cornett tells us that the middle is where the action is. Places like Chattanooga, which I visited, Provo, Boise, Idaho. How important, if you could, in a very summary way, tell us, are making certain that the bones of a community like in Des Moines, where you take a great central library and you convert it into a hall that has other purposes, technology and scale. When you think about the bones of a community, the technology and the scale of the mid-sized community, how important are all of those in combination?
Well, every city has assets, and we all live in cities that we didn't build. And so, I mean, I think you have to fundamentally understand that. So any group of citizens or any group of leaders are living in a city that they didn't really build, and they inherit it from the previous generation. And there are hidden assets in every community I've been in, regardless of how small or how big. In Oklahoma City, we rediscovered our river and turned that in, you know, from a negative into a positive. You mentioned Des Moines. You know, Des Moines River at least had water in it. Our river didn't even have any water. It was just a ditch. But Des Moines had some, you know, some aging architecture that had once been a sense of pride in the community. And they had kind of let it go, and it kind of had become some level of an embarrassment and deferred maintenance piled in. And they went back and rediscovered some of the roots. They've had a history of agricultural investments, but somewhere along the line, they either quit investing in them or quit promoting it. And, you know, with food in general becoming such a hot topic now, you know, in pop culture, Des Moines is using food as one of the rallying points to bringing the city back. Des Moines is one of those cities that had a downtown that didn't have very many people in it 10, 20 years ago that has thousands of people living downtown today. It's been a really neat environment and revival to watch. You know, it's one of those cities out there that people would enjoy visiting if they ever get an opportunity.
So in the next 10 years, when we look at the scale of these mid-sized communities in relation to the ones that are so large and so expensive and have really encouraged so much development over the years, do you think that's where the true action is going to be? And if there was one city that you've looked at as you've become a real scholar of this that we should keep our eye on, tell us what that is.
Tulsa, just 100 miles from where I am right now, has created what I believe is the finest urban park in the world. It just opened in September, and it opened largely the results of philanthropy, over $400 million from a philanthropist and others in the philanthropy community in Tulsa. It has an endowment to pay for all the operations. You know, like long term, Tulsa is going to see social and economic gain from that. Little Rock, Arkansas, is another city that I think is finding itself. It has the benefit of being on a major river, the Clinton Library, and a lot of other amenities that are located there. You mentioned Louisville earlier. I think Louisville is one of those cities. Out west, Albuquerque, Salt Lake City, and Provo are doing well. And these are not, you know, overlooked cities, but don't underestimate Minneapolis and Denver and places like that, too. They're going to continue to benefit.
Well, we benefited from hearing from you today, and we thank you so much for being part of America Trends, the next American city, Mick Cornett. And what a honor and congratulations on the great career that you built outside of broadcasting, where you started, and in the public sector. Congratulations on all your successes.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.